Accession number 18205, Reel 5.
McHodley, Reel 5.
Captain Matthews shouted out, OK, if you don't want to go on leave, stay where you are. Well, I think he's trying to catch me here, and I think I better appear. I'll have to take a chance and appear. So I emerged out from all the other bodies in the field, stood upright. He said, put your equipment together. He says, a 1,500 weight down there. He said, you've got to get in it. He said, we're taking you up to Suwon. He said, and you're going on leave to Japan. Well, I couldn't believe it. I still thought it was a bit of a joke. Well, my equipment, I just put it all together in an old poncho that we had and wrapped it round with telephone wire. And the equipment was our bedding roll, any bits of rations that you had. You know, just wrapped it all up with the telephone wire, picked it up with my rifle, and I'm on a 1,500 weight. When I get on the 1,500 weight, there's about, I don't know, I can't remember who went on leave with us, but I think must have been about 10 other soldiers. And in a jeep, there was the company commander of D Company, who was in charge of the party, Major Willoughby, accompanied by the adjutant, Nick Carter, accompanied by support company officer, his name just leaves me for a minute. I probably will remember it later on. But anyway, it takes the 1,500 weight with the jeep takes us up to an airfield at Suwon. And Suwon is being defended by the Royal Ulster Rifles, who are now pulling out. The Chinese are coming in and they're pulling out. And we was a bit fortunate that on the airfield, and I keep talking about the Australians because I thought they was wonderful fellas, there was a Dakota, Australian Air Force, Royal Australian Air Force Dakota, and he was taxiing. He was waiting for us to turn up and we was a bit late. And he was taxiing and he saw the transport come onto the airfield, he stopped. We all got on the Dakota and away we flew. And we flew down south to a place called Taegu. And we picked up some other British officers there. I think they must have been, they wasn't frontline officers. And I was a bit disgusted by the way we was dressed. You can imagine what we looked like. We're in a right, you know, lousy condition. And they made a complaint or something. And Major Willoughby, who was in charge of the party, he heard this and he really dressed them down. He really told them the story and it shut them completely up. Well, from there, we landed at a place called Iwakuni, which is in the south of Japan, and it was a RAF, an Australian Air Force base. They used to run sorties from there over to Korea. They gave us a meal when we arrived there. We spent the night there. Fortunately, we had a clean change of underclothing that we nearly always carried that in our small pack. We had showers for the first time for months and months. We changed our underclothing. Some of the other lads said, what are we going to do with our dirty underclothing? I said, well, we don't want that, do we? I said, leave it under the mattress of the bed. The Japanese girls would take that away. So we put it under the mattress of the bed. We came down for our breakfast. We're still all in our old rotten stuff. You know, it was all stained and really, you know, in a terrible bloody mess. We came down for our breakfast. We had that. And then the RAF paymaster, whoever he was, said, well, you're going up to Tokyo and leave now your pay. So we said, we haven't had no pay. Never got no pay when we was in Korea. You couldn't spend any money on. So I said, well, what do you think your entitlement is? So I said, I must have £100, which was a ridiculous figure, because I think my money, as far as I can remember, was about £2.50 a week. As far as I can remember, I may be wrong. There's no way I could have £100. So I said, oh, that's okay. So he asked us what we wanted. I don't know what the other lads, what they said. But I was a bit of a chance, so I wanted 100. I think they took less than me. And they signed the equipment, so I signed this roll. So the £100. gets our equipment together, take us down to the railway station, gets on an American troop train. And that takes us up to Tokyo. And it was quite a long ride. If I can remember, it was about an 18-hour journey. It was quite a long ride. And on this carriage where we was, there was an American sergeant in charge of the carriage. And they had American women on there that were American married families, you know, belonged to, that were wives of American servicemen. And they had sleepers there. So I said to this sergeant, I said, "Here, sergeant, any chance of a sleeper where we can get a red down?" "Oh," he said, "no, I don't know about that," he said. He said, "because on our way up there," he said, "we stop at various stations and other people get on them. They may, you know, have these beds." So he said, "but leave it to me," he said, "I'll see what I can do." So anyway, a few hours later, he come round, he said, "hey, I've got you a couple of beds," he said. He said, "but you don't," he said, "you'll have to sleep. You can't take your clothes off. You have to sleep with your boots on and everything," he said. So we said, "that's all right." So me and another fellow got a berth. And I don't know what time we woke up in the morning. It was fairly early. Somebody come round and said it was about 7 o'clock. And we woke all these women. "Who are you?" they said. "What the?" Of course, they're walking about. With, I mean, they're covered up, right? But they wouldn't be walking about. And we said, "oh, no, we're you know, we're soldiers and we just got..." And told them a story. And they said, "that's all right." And the sergeant come and said, "get out, boys, quick." He said, "go back to your carriage." So anyway, eventually we get to Tokyo Station, and it's the first time that I've seen one of these. You know, these at the airport, the, was it a concertina, wasn't it?
Carousel.
It's the first time I've seen one. We get out of Tokyo, and we're in a terrible state. I'll tell you, I think these Japs must have thought we'd just come out of Burma, out of the jungle, prisoners of war. And we've gone down to the entrance to get out of the station, and then this carousel, there's all our equipment coming down. Oh, Christ, what a state. Useless, it was all bits and pieces, bits of old sheeting hanging out where my stuff was tied up with this telephone wire, that was all hanging out. I felt bloody embarrassed, I did. Anyway, outside the station, there's an American coach, army coach, and that's going to take us to Ebershu Leave Hotel, run by the Australians. In actual fact, the Australians had a big radio station there. That's what it was used for. Anyway, we get in there, they make us have us a welcome. Said, "I'm out. Any chance of getting any beer in here, mate?" They said, "yeah, we've got a canteen down there." So, said, "why do we've got to pay?" He said, "oh, you have to buy tokens. You can't pay money." He said, "you have to buy a book of tokens." And I can't remember if it was, the tokens was in yen or American dollars, I can't remember. But he said, "you boys are paying for nothing." He said, you're with our lads. He said, "you're with the 3rd Battalion Royal Australian Regiment, 27th Commonwealth Brigade. You're paying for nothing." He said, "we're paying for the lot." Well, I thought, "please, no, this is all right. The old dogs, they're going to pay. We don't want to offend them by buying anything." They said, "yeah, we're paying for a lot. Don't worry about that." So we had our breakfast there. You still got all this rotten old gungy old stuff on. American coach comes along again, and it takes us to an American transit camp called Camp Drake in Tokyo. So we go in there, and the Americans take all our old stuff off of us. We have another shower and everything. And then we go into their quartermaster stores. I know they're pretty good. They look at you like that and they say, "that fits, that's your size, that's yours." So we all got issued out with American uniform. The only thing that we kept that belonged, that was proper to us, was our own army boots. But all the rest was American uniform. We even had their side hats. No insignia of USA, but so we was all dressed pretty smart. So we goes back to the Leave Hotel at Ebershu, and when the Australians saw us, they went mad. Of course, they didn't used to get on too well with the Americans, and they said, "hey, what's the matter with you bloody pommies? Ain't our uniform good enough for you?" We said, "yeah, it is, but you're too bloody tight to give us one. We better get these off the Americans." So that solved that situation. Now, pay. It's pay time again. Go down and see the Australian paymaster. Now, what? Now, you ledge, you haven't had no pay, we know that. How much do you want? Oh, I thought, bloody hell, I've got to be careful. You've had £100 all the way, yeah. I thought, I thought, how do I know what's going to happen to me if I go back to Korea? I said to him, I'm going to go in for another 100 here. I said, £100 or what? £100? He said, that enough? I said, well, oh, I'm entitled a few, Bob. I said, 200. Oh, what? He said, yeah, £200. Sign here. I've had £300. It all went in 6 days. Don't ask me where it went. They never ever caught up with that. I never had to pay that back. It's all got screwed up in their records. See, it was all disorganised then.
What did you spend it on then?
Oh. Booze and women. An Australian said to me, hey, mate, he said, oh, you want to do yourself a favour, he said. He said, go down to Ginza. That's the main drag in Tokyo. He said, and buy yourself three string cultured pearls. He said, you get them back to the UK. He said, they're worth a few bob.
Did you do it?
No. I thought myself, well, I can't buy them. I'm only going to put them in my small pack. And that, supposing anything happens to me, somebody else is going to have those pearls, so I might as well spend this money on having a good time when I've got the chance. Anyway, at the end of the leave, we had to go back to this American. We was a bit fortunate, it should have been 5 days, but we had seven, because Major Willoughby, who was in charge of the party, went downhill. And they stayed, being officers, they stayed in a different hotel than the other ranks. They stayed in an hotel called the Marunouchi Hotel, in the Ginza, in the heart of Tokyo. And he was laid ill. So we had an extra 2 days there, thanks to Major Willoughby. Instead of five, we had seven. So when it was our time to go back, we had to go back to Camp Drake, and Andy's American uniform was back to him, and all our other stuff, all our other old stuff, that had it all cleaned and gave it back to us, and we put it on. And then from there, we left. We said our goodbyes to the old diggers up in Leibershue. We got a transport down to Tokyo Airfield, and the American Air Force is now going to fly us back to Korea. And this was a laugh. And of course, we've all been on the drink. We'd all had enough, you know. And this American air crew, wherever he was, he said, well, look, he said, you blokes have got to wear parachutes. I said, wear parachutes? Well, he said, well, in case anything happens, so we had bloody parachutes in that aircraft, mate. So he said, well, you've got to wear them. So one of the other blokes said, well, I can't see the point of that. He said, 3/4 of the way, he said, we're flying over the sea, so what good are bloody parachutes? He said, you've got to wear them. So, all right. He said, form a circle round here. He got in the middle. He's got this bloody parachute on. Bearing in mind, we'd all had a bit of drink. He's putting his arm in this harness. His arm up through his legs here. Well, we tried to get it on. We nearly bloody strangled ourselves. He said, oh, forget the parachute. Just get on the plane. And that was, I brought back, from my mates and that, I brought back several small bottles of whiskey, 45 Revolver brand or something it was called, this whiskey.
It must have come hard going back to Korea after that.
Well, no, I didn't mind it too much. I mean, I was just thankful that I was lucky enough to be picked out for this, R&R leave.
You were telling me earlier off the record about the...
But, interrupting you a minute, but when you see... You get a great affection for the men that you're fighting with. And when I went back to Korea, it was like I was going back to my family. I was going back to where I belong, with all my mates.
You were telling me earlier off the record about the propaganda effort on each side. Can you repeat what you were telling me about the propaganda each side?
Well, yeah, there was... I'll show you those couple of leaflets there that we used to, you know, that they dropped to the Chinese. But the Chinese used to leave propaganda leaflets in their trenches. And I had one, and I had it for several years, but over the years it's disappeared. And I thought, you know, whoever wrote up or thought of this... propaganda, you know, it was quite sensible, really. I can only briefly go over the, you know, just the outline of it. But when you picked it up, It said, why fight for Mad MacArthur and die? It said, come over to our side and enjoy Christmas. The Chinese volunteer army will look after you. You'll be out of the fighting, you won't get killed, and everything will be okay. And they said, while you're over here, here is a communique from the Battle of Wall Street. And it went on that DuPonts have made so many millions, Henry Ford and all the big American companies have made many millions of pounds. And what are you getting out of it? You're fighting for them, but you're getting nothing out of it. You're mugs, you're idiots. Come and join us, and you'll be better off. I mean, obviously it went on more and more, but that's briefly what I can remember. And when I looked at it, and I thought, yeah, they've got a point, but they never changed my mind. You know, you're going to have rich and poor in this world, no matter where you go, and they can't change my mind.
And was there any propaganda by loudspeaker?
Not when I was there, no. No, not when I was there.
Did you see anything about the situation of the Korean civilians?
Yeah, pretty pitiful. Especially in the beginning. You know, when we was being pushed up and being pushed back, a lot of the civvies, you know, in the south, were being liberated, for the want of a better word, by the United Nations forces, and then we'd have to give ground, and the Chinese had come in, or the North Korean army, so consequently then people would retreat back to the south again. And some of the conditions were pretty pitiful. Mainly elderly men, or when I say elderly men, I mean in them days the Koreans aged pretty rapidly. You know, you'd think that man must be about 60, but in actual fact could have only been about 45. But there was mainly old men, very old women, and very young children. I never saw any young women, and this is the gospel truth, I never saw any young women all the time I was there. When I say that, I may have seen two or three, but I never see any young women at all. Whether they was hiding from the troops or what, I don't know. But those refugees, yeah, they was in a pretty bad state.
How did the troops treat them?
Well, you was mostly pushing forward, and they was coming back. I mean, the British soldiers, he is a pretty kind kind of bloke, and if they could help him, they would help him. If they could give him food, they'd give him food. But one of the, which I haven't told you, one of the biggest bugbears when that, you know, in the early part of the war, was the fact that my particular brigade never had no equipment. You know, they had their weapons, but I mean, as regards to clothing, it was very minimal. In actual fact, when I left the UK, we was issued with jungle green uniform. We're going to the Far East. I mean, what a mistake that was. Because when that winter started, it was late October, November, as far as my memory, you know, can take me. And it started off with a terrific wind. I mean, obviously, it was right up north, so the wind's coming through from Manchuria and Siberia. It's coming down from you know, up there. And I've never known cold like it in all my life. I wouldn't like to go through that again. The wind actually cut you in half. If you could get below ground, you know, you wasn't warm, but it saved that. The wind was the killer. When we used to take positions, you know, this, you might think this is stupid, but our main priorities was wood, water, and straw. Wood for our fires, straw to line our trenches with, and water for our tea, our brew up.
Why did you line the trenches with straw?
To keep them warm. I mean, sometimes the ground was so hard that you went down about 2 foot before you reached any, and sometimes further than that before you reached any soft earth. where it was frozen. I've never seen cold weather like it in all my life. And we never had the clothing to. Those American rations, I've told people this and they think I'm telling lies, but I'm not. Those American rations that I told you about, the only way of warming them up was to put them on an open fire. So what we used to do, we used to take the lid off, well not completely off, but half off, and put it on the fire, and that used to cook them up, eat them up. And then you'd use the rest of the lid so you could hold it and eat, spoon it out and eat it. Well, when that winter come down, my particular favourite was frankfurters and beans out of those American rations. And I used to swap a lot of stuff for the frankfurters and beans that other people didn't eat. So you could swap round. Some people like this and some people like... So you could swap round till you got, you know, near enough what you wanted. Well, these frankfurters and beans, as you know, beans have got a fair bit of liquid in them. You used to put them on the fire and the outside of the beans would be black and burnt and the inside would still be iced. You couldn't eat them. Our mess tins had gone by this time, so you couldn't put them out in a mess tin and do that. They'd gone. They'd all, you know, we'd lost them. So, you know, those are, you know, when I tell people this, they don't believe me, but that's a fact.
What did you think of the situation of the enemy troops as compared with the UN troops?
Well, I think there was, I mean, that, them conditions out there, they were probably more used to those conditions than what we were. And then at the same time, their rations are not exactly like the British Army rations. They tell me they can live on an handful of rice. I mean, whether that's so or not, I don't know. But I do know that the Chinese suffered with the cold because I think some of those Chinese troops come from the southern part of China. And they couldn't stomach that, them bad conditions that was up in the north. They told me that first winter of the Korean War was one of the coldest that they've had out there for years. Oh, it was bloody cold. Oh, it was cold.
You said that the Chinese propaganda went on about Mad MacArthur. Did you have any opinion of MacArthur in those days?
Yes, I did. I felt very sorry for MacArthur. I mean, I'm looking at it from, you know, from his point of view. I mean, at the end of the day, he must have been some kind of soldier, MacArthur. I don't say he'd done everything in the correct way, but he achieved his ends. And because he landed at Incheon, which was a brilliant, you know, idea, which he'd done, he's now rolling back the North Korean army, and he's rolling them right back to the Manchurian border. He now knows that Chinese has entered the war, And China have got big reinforcements the other side of the Yula River. They're building up all their arms and everything. And he knows that they've just come, they're going to come into North Korea. So obviously, from a soldier's point of view, he wanted to destroy that. And I can understand that from a soldier's point of view. But Truman, apparently, because of the situation with Russia, you know, it was a bit... He didn't want to escalate it. He said, MacArthur, no, you can't do that. Once they get into the north, then you can have a go. You can't touch their build-up. And MacArthur apparently said, well, I can't win a war like this. And when you look at it, he couldn't win a war like that. And I think he said a lot of things that Truman didn't agree with. And in the finish, Truman sacked him, didn't he?
You also told me a bit earlier about the problems of digging in Korea, if you can repeat to me what you were telling me about that.
Well, yeah, I can only say that you used to get a lot of movement. You'd get on position and you'd dig in and you'd probably be there 3 or 4 hours and then the order would come through. You go on further and you go to the next position and you dig in there. And it seemed sometimes you was forever digging in. But as I say, it was a bit of an hardship at times, but you don't know the situation on the ground. And you didn't mind digging in because you knew that was your own. That was giving you a bit of shelter.
Did you ever come across rats or other vermin?
No. I never come across any rats. I don't. I would imagine, well, I suppose they were up in the hills, but I can't personally say that I saw any rats or anything.
Did the troops get lice?
Oh, lice, we had lice, yeah. Yeah, we got lice. And the reason we got lice, because when that winter started, we couldn't remove, there's no way you could take your clothing off. And all the time we was there, for the majority of the time during that winter, we lived out on the hills. We wasn't in villages or things like that. We was up in those hills, dug in. And there's no way you can take any clothing off. You can't take clothing off. You just die with the cold weather. So round about April time, when it started to warm up a bit, we started taking our clothes off and we could get into the river and have a wash. And a lot of them did have lice. I didn't, but a lot of them did. It gets into the cracks of the, it's getting to the cracks of the clothing all around there.
The seams?
In the seams, yeah. Yeah, a lot of them had lice. It was only because we couldn't wash.
Did anybody catch any diseases or illnesses?
Not as far as I know. I mean, I don't understand, you know, when we lived out in those hills and I don't think any of us had colds or anything like that. None of us have got any colds. The only thing that that did happen, we was used to get very short of water sometimes. We used to melt the snow down, and it's surprising how much snow you have to melt to have a brew up. But then we used to have a water wagon that used to draw water from the local rivers, as wherever you may be. And they used to put so many purifying tablets into so many gallons of water. But it was a big tanker. And so you used to come down from the hills and draw your water from this tanker. You know, fill your water bottle up, or a jerry can, or whatever. But then when we came back from Korea, we had to be what they call dewormed because of the water. Now, a lot of the national servicemen had left the battalion before they was ever dewormed. So they must be all right, because I haven't heard of any. But what happened, when we came back after about 3 weeks, he was put on parade, you know, different companies went on parade. He went to the MI room, and the MO gave you a black tablet, in a plastic casing. Now, you swallowed that, but don't chew it, you've got to swallow it. You swallowed it, and then about an hour later, you was all taken in there again, and you was given a glass, and it was salt. It must have been salt of some kind, but it was almost soluble, but you could just about get it down. And as soon as it made you heave. Well, what it was, apparently, this tablet he gave you done something if you did have worms, and then this liquid salt or whatever it was that you drank, it made you spew up to remove. And we had, I think we had about 10 blokes in the battalion. And I think there was about 20 out of the Argyles with these tapeworms. And I've seen one of them. The MO had them in jars. And they were about that long.
Foot long.
Yeah. White. Horrible looking things.